Regular supplemental meetings called to order. We will recess the regular supplemental meeting.
Call the request for meeting order.
Public meeting order.
So we'll do, before we go to the public comment item, I just wanted to explain for the new board members. The statute in the bill in 2017 had some interesting items that it added to our statute, and this is one of them. So twice a year, we have to have what's called a required public meeting. And during that meeting, we have to talk about the health and the performance of the pension system. So we always have one of them when Siegel comes in and talks about the new actuarial evaluation, so that's why we're doing it at this one. So what we'll do is we have to have public comment for each of these items. So we'll have three public comment sections today. We'll have one in this meeting, one in the regular meeting, and one in the supplemental meeting. And then we'll talk about the actuarial evaluation. We won't make the motion for the actuarial evaluation until we actually go into the regular meeting. So that's what's going on here. So it's a little strange how we're starting this meeting, but it's just a little silly requirement that we have. So with that, you can call up the public comment.
Yeah. Is there any public comment? Anyone? I guess star 5 on the phone.
Nothing here.
My name is Mary Doster. I'm the surviving spouse for Dallas Fire Captain Jim Doster. I just wanted to let you know how much it would mean to a lot of us if we had a cost of living adjustment. He told me that I would always be taken care of. He kept his promise for 30 years, and I hope you do too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh my.
I'd like to call Michael Brown up.
So Michael was, as you all know, was a trustee for the last 5 years, and we didn't know at the end of the last meeting if he was going to be continuing as a holdover or not, but he's not. We're happy to have new trustees, but I wanted to thank Michael Brown for his service to the pension fund. He's been on the board 5 years. He's been a great resource for the staff. We have involved him in so much detail in some of our legacy of private equity, which has not been a fun experience for him, I'm sure, but we appreciate that. And he's also been a great sounding board. So I wanted to thank you from the staff for your service. So
thank you. Thank you. Interesting. When I came on the board, it was COVID. Our meetings for a while were strictly by phone, so I didn't know it. What anybody looked like and just had to kind of do it by voices. But it has been an absolute honor and privilege to work with the team, this incredible team, and to serve with all of the current and the former trustees. I am going to continue to help in any way I can. I'm going to stay on the IAC for as long as they want me on there, and so hopefully I'll be a part of working with the team going forward on redirecting the private equity investments into the appropriate private equity investments this time. So again, thank you very much. Best of luck to all the trustees, and I'm always a resource if I can be of any help. Thank you.
Stop that man before he leaves the building. We're back on board.
Can we say a couple comments?
Yes.
Well, I'd like to say on the record, Michael. Do not leave.
Lock the door.
I would like to say that I've been on this board for a long time, on and off for several years, almost since the beginning. And Michael Brown has by far been the most successful trustee in taking the time with our most troubled assets and being able to squeeze some water out of that very tight rock. So, I mean, the accolades, that was just magic, okay? Because I had taken that asset to be long gone, and only recently he's been able to really get some money back, and that's That is actually incredible. But aside from your acumen and your value added and what you know, you have been, I respect you so much. You inspire me to be better as a trustee and as a person. And I really, really, really honored the time on this board with you. So thank you. And I'm so glad you're going to be on the IEC too.
Go to Jeff.
Okay. Jeff Williams, do actuarial evaluation.
Eagle.
All right. Thank you.
I know there are a couple new board members I've not had a chance to speak with yet, but and I don't know what you know as far as pension plans, but just a quick what we do as the actuary is we determine the liabilities and the contribution requirements of the plan. Those are the two main things we're worried about here. We get the demographic data from the system. We get the asset information. We have a host of assumptions and methods we use to determine the liabilities. We put all that together and determine the contribution requirements. It's a real high-level description of what we do. I have the summary results for you today. These results will not change. There have been negotiations going on with the city, so we held off on finalizing the evaluation until we knew kind of where that stood, and we know where that stands now. So we have the summary results. The actual evaluation report will follow in the next week, but the results will not change. So the contribution requirement for the fiscal year beginning October 2026 is $304.6 million, which is 52.7% of projected payroll. Of course, employees contribute, members contribute 13.5%. The normal cost portion, the employer costs, which is kind of what's going towards this being approved each year, is including administrative expenses, is only 10.84% of payroll, which is not. Not bad at all. That's for important calls for a plan like this. That is really good, I think. But the remaining percentage, 41.1%, is the unfunded liability, which has occurred over time, gains and losses, assumption changes, plan changes. That's the bulk of the payment. It was a total loss on the year of 1.35% of liability. You had a gain on the investment side, but that was offset by loss from primarily salary experience. Salary increases greater than expected was the driver of the demographic loss. I'm not going to read all these. We did an experience study, quick recap, what that is. Every 5 years, we do what we call an experience study. We do a deep dive into the experience. We look at all the assumptions, all the methods, what happened compared to what we expected to happen. We do a little mini look at this each year. We really dig into it deep every 5 years, and we reset at that time because patterns change. People's retirement patterns change, turnover. You know, COVID occurred during this period. We discussed this last month. We didn't just go all the way to the full experience because we knew COVID impacted some of that as well, some of the turnover, retirement, and death. But the end of the day, we made a lot of changes here. The liability decreased by 1.38%. The normal cost, total normal cost, had a big increase. That's due to the salary scale. The changes that are going forward on the salary front was increased 16.37%. However, the overall impact was the actuarial determined contribution dropped by $4.3 million due to the experience study, I was happy with that. I mean, the normal cost had a large increase, but the overall, when you do an experience the assumptions, you get a decrease in cost, that's a win in my book. I've done enough of these. That's not usually the case, but it worked out well here. The fund ratios increased a little bit from year to year. 32.21% on a actual basis, 4% on a market value basis. For those, quick explanation for those who are new, the contributions are determined based on what's called the actuarial value of assets, which is typical for pension plans. We use a five-year smoothing of market gains and losses, and we'll show some experience later on as to why we do that. You don't want to. You know, this is a snapshot of 1 day in time. We're looking at December 31st, 2024 for this valuation. What was going on at that time? What was the demographic experience? What occurred in the markets during 24? And you don't want to. If you have a really bad year, you don't want to recognize that all at once. You could. Most plans don't, because you want a little more stability in your distribution requirements. And we'll look at that in a few pages. But it's typical. It's five-year smoothing. Right now you have $119 million in unrecognized asset gains. So that's good. You got a little bit of tailwind in your actuarial returns over the next couple of years. And your cash outflow decreased for the value. I mean, you had from negative $115 million to negative $98 million. So that's an improvement. But it's just saying that your benefit payments are greater than your contributions, or your benefit payments and expenses, I should say, are greater than your contributions. And on your return side, you have a target of 6.5% and a market return on a quarter actuarial return of 8.91%. So those are good. You're kind of you're unwinding from those assets that were holding you back, and the last couple of years you've had good market return. The summary side by side from the prior year to the current year. I mentioned the top line, the actuarial contribution. The fiscal year beginning October 1, 2026, $304.5 million. That's up from $262 million in the prior valuation. So pretty big increase, but you know, we know the contribution being made by the city don't equal the ADEC. So it's just going that gap is just gonna keep getting wider and wider, and those increases are gonna keep happening year over year. Other than that, it was pretty nothing unusual. Well, like I said, this reflects the experience study, so those liabilities are already in there. But your liabilities are typically going to increase year over year. It's just an ongoing pension plan. You're earning additional credit. The salary increases are larger than have been expected. It doesn't have an impact. But you're back over the $2 billion mark for this valuation. The projected year of full funding, that assumes the bottom line, 2053, that assumes the ADEC is paid this year, which you know, is not happening right now. History of the contributions, you know, for the past 10 years, there's been 1 year in which the ADEC was paid. So the just the lower that number is, that percentage on the right-hand side, that's just pushing the contributions further down the road. They add up. They add up in a hurry if they're not getting paid for it. Not a great page to look at, honestly, but it is what it is. Over the past 10, actually this is the past 11 years. The 2015 funding ratio is prior to $500 million in investments being written. So that's why the big drop from 15 to 16, along with other factors. But it's been fund percentage has been decreased. So we need to increase these contributions. That's the only way to turn this around, is having the contribution. So we projected, based assuming all assumptions are met each year and assuming the ADEC is paid each year. It's showing an increase to approximately, granted, you know, 30-year projection is not going to happen in like this. I mean, you can't, you know, if that my crystal ball worked, I wouldn't be here. 30-year projections are good for planning purposes, but we know things occur other than expected. But we're projecting over $600 million in contributions in you know, 30 years out. And that's if the ADEC is paid full each year. It's not getting paid right now in full, which means that contribution number is going to go higher and higher. I mean, we need money coming in. That's the bottom line. I mean, your projected It's going to be a long time before the funding percentage probably goes back up to where you want it to. I mean, it'll go up year over year as the market returns. But a steady increase is still a ways off, I think. This is the last, 17 years of returns. And you can see the 5, 10, 15, the averages are lower than normal, lower than we'd like, but we know the reason why. You guys were stuck with some assets you had to unwind. You're still unwinding. There were a couple of bad years in there that everybody had, 15, 22 especially, 08, of course. But that next year, if we do it, whenever 08 drops off, that whole 17-year history looks greater than the last 5 years. You had three really good market returns in the last 5 years in the top line, in 24, 23, and 21. But 22 threw everybody, kind of hurt everybody a little bit. These are actually fairly close. Well, they're fairly close together because you didn't have big fluctuations in actual returns when due to the issues we were having with the assets. Usually that's more of a zigzag on the actuarial and the market's more level. Population, except to say that the actives count just a little bit less than it was 10 years ago. The count goes up and down, the active count, but the in-base status is going to continue to increase. Fire and police is not a growth industry, so your active count is always going to, it's been within a certain range. Hopefully that'll increase, but the retiree count will keep going up, those in pay. So that just puts more pressure on Makita and your investment folks because the contributions don't be so much. It's a combination of contributions and investment returns.
I mean, if you look at the beginning and the end of that table, we have over 1,000 more retirees now than we did in 2015, and we have fewer active employees.
59 less active, over 1,000 more retirees.
Although the contributions go up because of increased wages, the liabilities also go up because then so that's going to happen, right? It's not one for one. It's going to be a bigger liability than even the contributions today.
Yeah, the liabilities will go up faster than the contribution balance.
Yes.
The plan is it's approaching $6 billion in liabilities. With about $2 billion in assets. So there's a long way to go to make up that fund liability. It's certainly, on paper, it's certainly doable. I mean, if this amount is made ADEC each year, then by default it will be fully funded. But that depends on the contributions being made.
Right. And you keep on saying contributions because the investments as
well, the investments obviously matter. You have to hit the target as well.
But it's 5 years smooth, right? So
right.
It's never going to be that, even on great years, never going to be
right.
That.
I mean, the investments are really where that's the big money part. But the contributions are not, if you have a $300 million contribution requirement and they're only paying $200 million, well, that $100 million each year, that difference really adds up. So the combination of the two. But yeah, the investments obviously are extremely important in the last couple of years. We've been looking good, but we need contributions.
So you think contributions are more important?
Well, we kind of, I wouldn't say that they're as important. Yes.
Aren't there a lot of dials working all at the same time? And so, it's tough because a lot is inflated in here, which means there was a lump of assets that were underperforming that you could sell at a time, and you clean them up. And so the smoothing aspect of this is hard to see until you see the actual valuation and market valuation start tracking each other. But then inside there's some smoothing because there's performance for it as well. But there are a lot of things that are happening at the same time.
Oh, there's a ton of moving parts here. You get the demographic information, but the salary increases on the demographic side are are big. You know, those that road the
The other thing that I don't want to distract is what you're driving at is the delivery of dollars into a point in time where you have a strong market. The smoothing actually kind of delays the impact, but it doesn't reduce the magnitude over time. So if you have an extra $300 million that's invested in a good period of time, the impact of that on this fund is tremendous. It'll be smoothed out over time. But that movement of a 15 or a 12% return or a 20% return, heaven help us, it's moved out in 5 years, so you don't see it.
You don't see the full impact immediately, that's correct.
But it'll shift that curve tremendously over time.
Right, and you know the reason we smooth pension plans of certain sizes smooth is we'll look at the revenues on the top line. Oh, wait, do you want to reflect the full 25% loss in the market value immediately? I mean, that's hard to swallow. You know, there was a lot of plans across the country made major changes in 09 and 10, 11, after the aftermarket of 2008. And, you know, the good years are great. I don't capture that, but it's protecting the downside. You don't want to get, you don't want to have to make a change that's going to affect your members and your retirees based on one bad year or one bad month. I think it was 15, maybe. Market was going fine, I believe. Investment professionals can correct me, but December hit the skids, and all of a sudden it was a bad year.
Right.
And that's the whole reason to protect the smoothing. You don't want to, you know, one bad month in the market. All of a sudden, you're lost 8.5%, and then you don't want to make changes that are going to affect people based on one kind of blip in the market. So we smooth out the impact over time.
Yeah, my point being is the other side of that is if you have a hole, you don't wait until a backhoe shows up, you get a shovel and you start filling it as fast as you can.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So that's the other side of the smoothing corridor. Mm-hmm. It makes all the sense in the world, but I just want to make sure that filling the hole faster and as soon as you can makes that look a little bit better than waiting until somebody shows up with a dump truck.
Right. I'm not worried about Makita doing their job. I mean, they don't have control over the market, obviously, but they're going to take care of their business. And, you know, I'm not an investment professional, but that's not what the concern is. The concern is on the contribution side.
Right. And time. I mean, the whole exercise here is time is your friend. If you use it appropriately, time is your enemy. If you don't use it appropriately,
absolutely.
Yeah. So, Jeff, will you go to this? On this page here, you'll see in 20.
This, well, shoot.
That one.
Okay.
The dots are together in 2022, and that is when we were first negotiating with the city on the plan funding things. The CFO wanted us to. Chiron wanted Chiron basically to use our numbers as if we realized all the actuarial losses immediately. So we did that, which no other plans really did. So we and Siegel didn't like it, but we had already had the numbers done. And I don't either. So we actually recognized those losses a lot sooner than other plans, although we didn't recognize the gains in the next year, so it's a little bit strained in there. City wanted it because they
do like I'm sorry, explain that to me. Why did you recognize more of the losses up front?
Because the city wanted Chiron to do that because they were thinking it was helping them smooth the increases in the ADC. In the end, it didn't matter, but that was a request from the city that we do that. And we did it, and I actually kind of regret it. It doesn't mean anything. It just makes, you know, our funding on an actuarial basis look a little worse, but 32 versus 34.
I mean, if they're not going to pay the ADEC, then it's like, does it matter almost? I mean, it does matter. But so 22, you know, negative 11.5% market return. So, and we had many conversations about this, and I will tell you when we're talking on the phone, I'm very blunt, more so than now. But, recognizing that loss immediately just made no sense to me. But you know, I'm just the actuary.
One more comment, or maybe shift. There was a lot of discussion about assumption rate, and that purple line is the assumption rate.
Yeah.
Period, right?
Yeah. So,
and I'd like to talk about like the appropriateness at a funding level of the assumption rate.
Sure. You're currently at 6.5%. I know that there have been, so obviously the lower the rate, the liability is higher, less discounting future. You guys all understand that. But when I hear certain folks saying, well, we should increase the rate, it'll be less contribution requirement. Well, first of all, they're not paying the contribution requirement. But aside from that fact, what are they basing this on? A 17-year average of 1.83% return? I mean, it's when you're looking at the discount rate and investment return assumption, you're looking forward as much as back. A lot of the times we're doing experience studies, you know, we don't know what the retirement's going to be in the future. We can't really predict that as well. So a lot of times we're setting it based on what's happened in the last 5 years on recent experience. And if we know if there's information available to us about what might happen in the future, then we factor that in as well. Well, with on the investment side, you know, we're looking at capital market assumptions, and we're looking at what's projected over a 20-year period based on the asset allocation of the fund. I would be very much against increasing the rate of return at this time. There's been three good years out of the last five on the market side. But I think you need more than that. I mean, it's a combination of the what's projected on your asset allocation, the capital market assumptions you're looking at. There's a page I include in the insurance study which I'm here now, which y'all see before. It's on NASRA, the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. They do a big survey each year of public sector plans. In their most recent survey, I may be mixing up the median and the average, which one is which, but I think the median return to the public sector universe is 7 and the average is 6.91 now. So you are a little bit less than that, but you've also had other issues to deal with. If we get a sustained period of strong increases, that could be a different conversation, but at this point, I don't see a valid reason to, in my opinion. I'm not an investment professional, but I don't see a reason to increase that assumption.
But couldn't we look at it tactically, though? I mean, there's a strategic overlay, but there's also a tactical overlay. So if you take an investment professional and you say, you know what, 20% of your fund is underperforming and there's not a darn thing to do about it. I can't sell it to anybody. I can't leverage it with anyone. I can't do anything. And then you look at the return on the full AUM or corpus of the plan. Tactically, you're getting a 6% market return, but the reality is you're getting it on 80% of the assets. 20% is either doing nothing or is pulling down the curve. And so as you look at the actuarial rate of return, as the team has done a great job of trying to recognize some of that value, guys who walk out the room help recognize some of that value, is there an argument that now I've got 95% of the focus of the fund actually moving and I can rebalance, that there's a tactical argument, an operational argument for raising the actuarial return. And then, if you add in the fact that at some point we're going to get to a solution putting more capital into the system.
But doesn't it reflect, but according to Jeff, he says that if you also you can't ignore what just happened 5 years before and anticipation 5 years in front.
Actually, we're bringing Robert's report to file address to the table, not the person.
Oh, okay.
But the reality is it works both ways, right? So it's the same reason I don't want to recognize the drawdown, the same reason that it underweighs a strong performance year, the same one thing, which is I'm looking back, thinking back to the past future, but do we really expect to have a good chunk of the fund not performing and not being able to rebound? If we are, then sorry, Ryan, we should actually leave right now. But we get the other side of that, which is cleaned up a mess, and we have a 6% return while we were carrying, and now that the mess is cleaned up, and we're in the capital. It would argue that the actuarial rate of return should go up because it got more assets and that needed to be 20% of the fund going against it.
Jeff, what is your response to that?
My response is, that, again, I'm not an investment professional, but you said at some point there will be assets flowing in, but that point's not here yet. We have no idea when that's going to be, if or when. We've been hearing some point for years and years, and that still ain't happened. So I think if the city, I'm not trying to dump on the city, but, yeah, if the city ever commits to paying the ADEC, and actually does, and is sustains that, and we get rid of all the junk assets, and the returns are coming in, then that's a whole different conversation. I'm not trying to keep the rate down just to keep the rate down. You know, that doesn't do anybody any good. We're trying to deal with what's been happening, and what we expect to happen, and just right now, the money's not coming in, and it's hard to get the returns.
Respectfully, that's not your job.
No. Well, it's
not. Your job is to actually do an actuarial evaluation. You have done with great assumptions. Our job is to say, well, what does that tell us and what you're going to do about it?
Right. I can't control the rate of return. The for public sector plans, the board of trustees is responsible for the assumption. Now, if you guys set an assumption so egregious that I have no, there are certain guidelines we have on our end, and if there was an assumption that we're like, I can't stand by that, there would be a big, huge comment in the report stating that. but ultimately, I can't control the assumptions. When I do experience study, I present to the board.
But here's a perfect example of what you just said, and I'm not picking at you.
That's fine.
The quality of the report allows us to have this conversation. But you said among our peer groups, there's a 90 basis point differential.
The median or the average, I can't remember which one right now. It's one of them is 6.91, one of them is 7. So it's either 50 basis point or 41 basis point.
Okay. Sorry, I thought it was 6.
Yeah.
But there is a differential. And then I would ask the same question, which is how many of those plans actually have a corpus of underperforming assets?
That I can't answer. I would guess not to the extent that y'all had to deal with.
And that's the point that I'm trying to make. I'm not trying to grasp. It's just there's a lot of dials you have to look at. And when you
put
them together, and again, not your job is to basically say, well, now that you've changed those jobs, what have you done to yourself?
Right.
Based on performance in the past and demographic overlay. Our job is to say, we look at all those dials and say, you know what? The rate of return might need to go up. You know what? If someone's going to give us a corpus and the ADC is paid, we need to take that as quickly as possible.
So Jeff,
but we need to get there first.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Yeah.
And we
in
have to have certainty that's actually
absolutely. Yep.
In this median and mean of those, what percentage of those are 32% funded?
That I don't know, but I'm guessing not very many. I mean, I don't have, it's not broken out like that. I could probably figure that out with a lot more research.
So some of this is with higher funded. These numbers are achieved by or obtained by pensions that are higher, that are more funded than ours.
I would say most of them, yes.
Okay. Thank
I'm
you.
Sorry, I'm listening. I'm trying to find something from the experience study.
You can't do aerobatics.
And trust me, you have to just
touche. You're right. I can just recommend, as you know, the board knows and the staff knows, I'm not shy about giving out my opinions, but again, that's not, I can only advise, I can't implement. Sorry, I'm trying to find that, well,
I'm finding
it right
it
now.
Too.
But I think we've hit pretty much all the, let me see if there's anything I wanted. Just a demographic breakdown.
Jeff, what's the average inflation rate that's been used by the universe?
I'm sorry?
The inflation rate that goes into
that I'd have to check. It should be that NASA study. I believe it's somewhere in the mid two.
Okay,
I would say you two. I can't take that for a fact. I need to double check that.
Okay,
so I believe it's in the mid two range.
Very good. Thank you.
So I mean, so we'll have the full report over the next couple of weeks. We'll send it out. But unless there's any questions, those are the highlights from the.
Thank you, Jeff.
So when we go into the regular meeting, we'll make a motion to accept it. And when we get to, normally we have the full report, but like Jeff said, that we didn't, we had him delay doing the full report in case we were able to make an agreement with the city. So after the mediation, I told him to go forward with the full report. So we'll get that. We'll send it out. It'll be either you'll receive it before the next meeting or when we do the audit.
All right, I need a motion to adjourn the required public meeting. Second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. We're going to convene the regular meeting. We need to welcome and recognize our new trustees. Scott Lettier is a new Maple trustee.
Glad to be here. Hope I can help the ball club.
Yvette Duane is the new non-member.
I'd like to say thank you. I'm pretty honored to be elected, and I hope that my experience in the investment industry and with meeting with public pension boards that it could provide some value and, I'm just very, I want to remain committed to the fire, police, retirees, and their families. And, I just want to make sure my decisions are made with integrity, and I appreciate being here. So thank you.
Tina Hernandez-Patterson is a new non-member trustee and making a return to the board.
I'm glad to be back.
You came back.
You can't hear
him. Michael already left, but Michael Brown was our outgoing legal trustee. We have a moment of silence for police the fire pattern last month because it's 9/11 today, remembering what happened in 2001. Okay. We need to approve the minutes for the regular meeting of August 14th. Just going to let them go over with a motion to approve those minutes.
Move to approve the minutes August 14th, 2025.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. Do you have any other comments?
Good morning. Kara Meddleton, Dallas City Council. And first, I want to say thank you for your hard work. Second, in case you didn't know, this morning, Governor Abbott is recognizing families of Darren Burke, Farmer, and David, who were killed in the tragic accident. And the second thing is, based on your discussion about the plan, I would say if there's something you need from the city, you should actually tell us. So as you get your final report, if you have something that you want from the city, you should outline it. As simple as that. Because we have two council members here. Not most are paying attention to what you're talking about. And there's information that you have that we don't get it. It's just flat out not communicated. And while occasionally we have staff that is allowed to answer questions, your board is not represented with the president. We have new council members. We don't know the whole situation. And so hearing from you directly, I think, will help fully.
Thank you, Madam Councilwoman. Thank you for mentioning Darren Burks. Those of you who don't know, he was one of the best we have to offer. He's the best of everything.
Did you want to speak? Rick?
Oh, no.
Okay. That you want to speak. I'm sorry. Okay.
I was going to say something real quick. Sarah had mentioned Jeff Patterson, president of the Firefighters Association. Also wanted to recognize that recent retiree, Lieutenant John Hampton, is being recognized as well in Austin, getting a Star of Texas Award. He was the lieutenant, was part of the Engine 11 that went off the overpass about a year ago. He is retired now. He's still dealing with some complications, but he is being recognized with that Star of Texas Award today in Austin by Governor Hampton.
We can do a motion for the actual evaluation.
Okay. So, I make a motion to approve the issuance of the January 1st, 2025 actuarial evaluation, subject to final auditors review and approval by the executive director. I'll move. Okay, second.
Second.
Motion is second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
Come back with some better news next time.
It was a little bit of a
highlight. It was lower improvement.
It was lower.
Yes, I've seen
lower than
since I've been here.
Yeah. Right. We need to appoint some members to our committees. So I would like a motion to appoint Michael Brown and Hernandez Patterson to the IAC with terms to end on 9/9/2027.
Moved.
Second. Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. I'd like to find a motion to appoint Scott Lapierre to the audit committee. Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. And a motion to appoint the Hernandez to the Special Services Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. All right. Fully vote date, right?
All right, thank you, Michael. I'll move through this relatively quickly since we have a full agenda today, but stop me at any point you guys have questions. Looking at the portfolio through end of August, the total portfolio was up 9.4%, with the public portion, which is now almost 82% of assets, returning 11.6% year to date. We've received $15.6 million of private market proceeds year to date, as you guys know, but just as an update for the newer trustees on other initiatives. We recently terminated Eastern Shore, U.S. Small Cap Manager, and we transferred that to a passive fund in early August. And then last month, the board approved a new multi-asset credit strategy to go into public credit allocation with ICG. We're working on legal and plan to fund that later this year. On other investment initiatives, we're spending a lot of our time looking at on private equity buyout and secondary opportunities, and then also diligencing some additional private credit commitments. We'll likely bring some opportunities to the subcommittee to review in the next few months and then have something come back up to the board by year end. Some of the questions we fielded from the board on the public equity portfolio regarding global positioning, active passive weight, small cap allocation. We're looking at those, and we're going to bring some thoughts back to the IAC at the mid-October 23rd meeting, and then we'll bring any recommendations on changes, if there are any, back up through the board. And then looking ahead into next year, on the public side of the portfolio, we likely have three searches that we need to work through, so we're trying to prioritize those, but likely we remain in small cap, a U.S. small cap search, potentially a global value search, and then the addition of a second multi-asset credit manager at some point. A few market charts. This is looking at top 10 U.S. companies over time. The Mag 7 companies are highlighted there in yellow, and I think the point here is to highlight how much rotation we typically see in the top companies. Apple is the one that's been there the longest, going back to 2010, or actually Microsoft going back to 2000, but a lot of rotation, in these top companies. And if you actually looked at this as of Tuesday, Oracle would now be in the top 10. So even though the Mag 7 companies are leading the market and quite concentrated, we don't, you know, we would expect rotation going forward. To that point, the passive index, the global ACWI IMI, has about an 18.7% weight in those Mag 7 companies. Our global equity managers are quite a bit underweight to that, which with about 6.6% allocation. When you add back in the passive, we end up about 10% to the Mag 7, but we're pretty underweight to those seven companies. Next slide is just looking at kind of a contrary view here, where the U.S. market is very concentrated, but when you look at other countries, we're not that much more concentrated in the top 10 than, you know, Canada, Germany, some of these other countries. I think the counterpoint to that would be the U.S. is such a big share of the ACWI above 60%, which gives us some concern. Looking at equity market returns year to date, we're still seeing international outperform U.S. by about 10%. So international EM are leading the way year to date, but you know, when you look back at the 3 year, they're still trailing U.S. markets by a pretty decent margin, international catching up a bit with the performance year to date. So moving on to the performance of our public managers, which, as I said, now above $1.7 billion, we're outperforming at high level, a 60-40 over almost every time period except for the 1 month. Looking at the public equity, we're seeing kind of what you'd expect with a four-manager portfolio that takes different positioning, but two of our managers with Boston Partners being a deeper value manager and a lot of international exposure, and WCM are outperforming by quite a bit. And then our two core managers, more core quality managers with Manulife and Walter Scott, are underperforming. And then you can see the addition of the Russell 2000 passive index down there with $63 million invested. And then Global Alpha is our international small cap manager. Their performance has struggled, but if you look at absolute returns year to date, they're never going to keep up in a market that's up 26%. They're up 20% year to date. Looking at our fixed income portfolio, performances outside of cash on the 1 month, we're doing all green across the board, so that's good. And then in the credit portfolio, the one to point out here is if we looked at these numbers about a year ago, Loomis, our U.S. high yield manager, was struggling quite a bit. They're outperforming by almost 2% over the 1 year period. They've, you know, almost caught up on the 3 year trailing to the benchmark. So good performance over the last year from them. We ended the month at $2.1 billion in AUM, $45 million year to date in net benefit outflows, and $184 million in investment gain. Safe reserve is full. So $196 in cash and short-term bonds compared to a target allocation of $191. That's enough to cover benefit outflows through March of 28. So plenty in the safe reserve right now. We rebalanced the money of the equity portfolio in late July.
Our requirement's 15 months?
Yeah, I mean, so it's always a discussion. Here we're looking at it from a total month time period, so we have 9% target allocation, which is the 191. That was intended to be 18 months, but as the numbers have come down from 10 million a month to 9 million, to it's running at 6.3 right now, that gives us more months of coverage in that 9% allocation.
At what point do you feel comfortable of us having a discussion of lowering that reserve time?
I'm always comfortable having the discussion, but I mean, I think the point there would be. Yeah, so if we look at our total asset allocation, we only have 13% in fixed income, investment grade, and cash. I think what we probably look at, I think that's in line, maybe a little bit lower than peer plans. So I wouldn't say we should take 4% and just put it into private equity or public equity. I would say we should probably, you know, over the next year, look at maybe the cash allocation coming down a little bit from 3%, and then the difference between our fixed income and cash versus peers, we have a shorter duration profile was 6% of that 13 being in 1 to 3 year. So maybe we look at the duration profile of the fixed income portfolio.
Only because we initiated the reserve at some point because the liquidity of the fund was problematic.
Mm-hmm.
So now that that liquidity has been improved and our allocations or being able to sell things or rather easily, I mean, it's not practical and really have, you know, the depth and speed is what I'm just alluding to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something to look at. I mean, this is all within fixed income, but if you look at the five-year period, it works out with the rates going up that are 1 to 3 year, and cash. Cash is actually the best performing asset over that time period.
Why don't we run with that for a minute? And I'm not addressing, you know, because that was the board, but following up on Ms. Hernandez Patterson's point, what would happen if, one, we actually reduced that but paired it with the securities and lending? Or two, what would happen if we actually in the city that in the interim we're trying to work through this, we want to be able to get back or access the city's line of credit or a commitment from the city that we have a drawdown of the actually the need to pass the liquidity reserve. So $196 million is actually for Ryan and $196 million at work. At 9% over 30 years of debt, that makes a big difference. And so, the ability to deploy that capital, knowing that we need to have a security lending function, or we need to have a city in the event that there was a drawdown and we couldn't fund obligations. Because the whole issue is what do you do if you're stuck and you don't want to sell something, but you need to accommodate benefits? And that's easy enough to solve with either a line of credit or the ability to security.
Yeah, I would have to study the securities lending issue more to understand kind of that. Yeah. I think you're right in that, you know, the function of the fixed income portfolio, whether it's cash and short term or we call it reserves or we just call it fixed income, is to be able to rebalance into weakness when equity markets are down, or in our case, be able to pay benefit payments and not sell equities when they're down. So if we had an alternative to that, that would be something to explore. But I think, I'll let Leo chime in here. I think, you know, our risk profile of the investment portfolio would be quite a bit different and more aggressive than most of our peers if we took that stance.
Yeah, but maybe to David's point, though, what's wrong with just exploring the option out?
No, I mean, I think it's some to look at. I mean, given where we're at with the city, I doubt we get access to lines of credit.
Rather quick, wouldn't you say,
yeah.
Ryan?
But,
I mean, it is a tall order to ask the city of Dallas to extend to us a lending facility or some kind of mechanism.
Yeah.
In light of.
So what's the cost of inquiring?
Nothing. I'm happy. I will encourage it 100%.
Maybe. I think it's something to explore because it's always been a question on the safety reserve. How much of a drag is it? When should we get rid of it? What should it look like? I know Makita has, you know, introduced like a risk mitigating bucket into a lot of their client portfolios that I think kind of serves the same function as what we're looking for here. But I mean, maybe just speak, Leo, to kind of our fixed income allocation and some of the comments and what else we could look at. It's
sure.
When we do asset allocation.
Right, remember this. A couple years ago, I coined the term creating a buffer for the buffer.
Yeah. No, and I think we've thought about that when we rebalance. Like, I would rather run the, given we know what the cash flows are, instead of rebalance, so we're going to be back to target 4 months after we pay a bunch of payments, rebalance to target and let it bleed down and then rebalance, you know, opportunistically from the equity portfolio like we did at the beginning of Q3.
Pick your number, we're 32% funded or we're 34% funded. And so we don't look like anybody I can think of other than maybe it's the Illinois Teachers Retirement Plan. And so we certainly shouldn't look like everybody else because we aren't in the same health position as everyone else. So, Ryan, just put it on a plaque so there's no career risk. I can't. Everybody said do this and everybody forgot when it went against us. We had to go talk to the city. So put it on a plaque on that wall that the board asked you to do this. But I do think trying to figure out how we get more of the corpus working in the interim while we're working everything out.
Yeah, that's a valid point for sure. Just on, it kind of relates to the last discussion, but we talked about kind of, and I'll let you go next, Leo, kind of what is left that is not kind of functionally working for us and producing returns. It's, you know, we're down 18% in private markets. About 10% of that is kind of the legacy, you know, value unknown. Huff Energy is a big part of that at 6%. So it's been reduced from 50% of the portfolio down to 10%, but it still is 10% that is, you know, more questionable what the outcome will be. Leo, your thoughts?
I just have one question.
Yeah, go ahead, Tina.
Specific and granular about this is that for as far as report cards go, talk to me about Walter Scott and their performance.
Not good. We had a quarterly review with them last month. They're a quality manager. It's a big up market, so quality hasn't been rewarded is kind of one explanation. The other explanation is they are significantly underweight to the AI theme. They don't believe the amount of CapEx, you know, these companies are spending are going to, you know, translate to earnings down the road. So they're, you know, when we talk about our Mag 7 underweight, they're a big contributor to that.
When you look even at the, like, 3 and 5 year, I mean, like, that gives you enough cycle to have performed in some manner in that time frame.
Yeah. I mean, all these managers ebb and flow. I would point to Boston Partners as a manager that we looked at in 2019 and 2021 because they were significantly underperforming because of their style and their U.S. underweight, and now they, you know, look very good across those same time periods. So I don't think it's, you know, to the point where we should consider making a change, but we're closely monitoring it.
But even the 5 year, even if you look at 2021, if you go back 5 years, I mean, their numbers aren't terrible. I mean,
I agree totally. I think what I want to be cognizant of is having an active portfolio where we end up terminating every time a manager underperforms is not going to be outperforming.
How long have you been with us?
They've been with us since 2009. I guess one other mitigating factor, we moved them to a performance-based fee about 3 years ago, so we're, while they're underperforming, paying a much lower.
You know, you get what you pay for.
Agree. But we're looking at them, you know, that's kind of part of what we're looking at with the public equity review. So there's a few managers that we, you know, when we start seeing a lot of red, we, you know, always talk to them once a quarter, but we try to dig in a bit more, understand what's going on. It's not that they've changed anything. It's not that they've lost personnel. It's, you know, they're investing the same way they invested in 2009. It's just, you know, hasn't worked.
But in these markets, they have to have lost assets. Or investment.
Yeah, I mean, they have about $60 billion-ish. Maybe you guys can check that real quick. But they're established manager that have, you know, have international equity, global equity platform. So it's not a situation with the small cap manager where they were bleeding assets and bleeding assets quickly. It's been pretty stable in terms of their AUM. Okay, Leo, you're here now.
Right. There's been lots of questions. I like that engagement. So it's okay. I'll just jump into my slides, and I'll try to weave in answers and comments on the different topics that we'll have today. And if you have additional ones or you want to go more in depth, please just start talking. So we'll start with a snapshot. And I have the control. Thank you. All right, so these the numbers you saw from Brian were as of August 31st. This is as of June 30th. So we'll take a snapshot looking at a one-year metric. And performance is strong, 10%, certainly above the actuarial assumed rate, on par with peers and somewhat behind our policy index. We'll get into details as to what's been driving that, but probably not a surprise to find out that the legacy illiquid assets have been the primary reason for your lagging versus your policy. Overall, the impact of asset allocation overweights and underweights has been de minimis. It's been all an issue of implementation and how those managers in your portfolio perform versus the benchmarks, what has driven that underperformance in the year. Overall, of what you can control, essentially your public market strategies, they have performed on average quite well. Most have beat benchmarks and peers over the year, but also over other trailing periods. So when you look at those green and red, most are greens, and there's a handful of reds, and I'll provide some comments on Walter Scott, Global Wealth Fund, and a few others. You saw this chart already as of August, so I won't skip it. Yeah. That's right. It's going up. Going the wrong, pressing the wrong button.
There you go.
This one?
So if we look at the safe reserve, so it's 8% of the fund, $107 million. What's the return on that safe reserve, and what is that return relative to the return on the overall fund? So what's the differential gap?
Yeah, I'm sorry, the return, the differential gap between the safe reserve and?
Safe reserve and the return on the overall fund.
2%.
Sure. Let's work it out. Find the right page.
What time period do you look for?
So let's look at the last year.
Yeah, so if you look at the last year, the fund made 10%, and the safety reserve made, you know, right around between 5 and 6.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that, it, you know, rates being higher and what they're in.
I understand the analysis, but you get it.
Yeah.
Duration
is
your friend.
Yeah.
Risk can be your friend.
For sure.
Dealing with 30-year income. Would you rather have that money, or would you rather leave it as, you know, the cost of actually being safe for 15 months of liquidity in case you need it? Because I guess, Kelly, have we ever drawn on the safe fund?
Yes.
And yep. At what level?
In 2022,
In 2020, we did. In 2022, we did.
And how much? How much was the drawdown?
We drew it down pretty significantly. I'd have to get back to exact numbers. In 22, we also were able to rebalance private market proceeds back into equities at lower levels. In 2020, it was a quicker kind of V-shaped recovery, so we didn't draw as long there. And part of what we looked at when we lowered it from 15% to 9 was, you know, how much do we really need in there? And it wasn't 30. We determined 18 was prudent. But like I said, I think what we need to look at when we do asset allocation is what, throughout the term safe reserve, what level of fixed income, you know, balance of the portfolio, investment grade fixed income, should we have in a portfolio that's 32% funded?
Well, and Ryan, you actually answered a better question than what I asked, which is, was the drawdown for balancing purposes or was the drawdown a benefit?
It was, we used it for both, but, it was more used to pay benefit payments where we didn't have to sell anything. In a time we didn't have private market proceeds coming in, we were able to pay benefit payments out of that. And like I said, the other factor, the level of absolute dollars leaving the plan per month was a bit higher. It keeps going down gradually, and it will go down further if we get funding from the city. Yeah.
Which is, hey, what's the number that you have to have if you went to the city and said, you know what, we
To provide some further perspective, we came on board in 2018. At the time, half the fund was illiquid. About half of that was in legacy assets, some of which have very uncertain payout profiles as well as amounts. And so we view those as binary. And so from that perspective, the safety reserve or the, you know, cash element serve a very special role. It has come down, but we still have assets that are illiquid, that are legacy, and some of which the payoff is very uncertain in terms of time and value. We conduct at least every 3 years, or more often if needed, in-depth asset allocation, asset liability studies. And so I think we're due for that. You know, at some point in time here, Ryan will know the exact time in which we did the lesson and when we're due. But to the extent that, you know, we, you know, eventually move out of those legacy positions, I think that would be the right time as well to revisit all of this in more detail.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a full write-off of half just to make them something, that's going to be a big hit. And so who knows what the actual turnout on that one will be.
Yeah. We last started the asset allocation study at the beginning of 24, got approved just last year. Normally we're on a 3-year cycle, but I think we'll talk amongst staff, and it may be prudent to look at it sooner given the question.
How often is the IPS asset allocation and the IPS addressed?
Every 3 years. Like a few times, like we got rid of our global bond portfolio, we opened it back up just to get rid of that one line item. But we probably have amendments annually, but the full kind of re-looking at the asset allocations on a 3-year, at least every 3-year cycle. But as I said, given some of the questions, funding might change. New trustees, it may be prudent to start talking to the IAC about doing that sooner in the cycle.
Given the liquidity.
Yeah.
So formally, it's every 3 years is what we have all come to agree. Informally, or less formally, we review it constantly. At every meeting, we know where we are versus our target. And if there is something that needs to be changed, we would be proactive, as would staff. The policy statement typically once a year gets updated. Sometimes it's minor changes. But in terms of an asset allocation, we go by the 3-year metric at this moment, which is consistent with best practice and most peers.
I have a question. So on the drawdown that we were talking about on liquidity, during that time frame when you were, drawing down money for the plan, was it in high-quality fixed income assets at that time when you stated those years that?
Yeah, I mean, we start with the cash allocation. You know, there may have been in the 1 to 3 year, like for a week or two, it may have been down a little bit, but it's pretty stable returns. So we were selling either, out of the cash portfolio, and then we might have tapped IRM, which is our 1 to 3 year manager, to refill cash. But yeah, it's very stable.
It was very stable. No issues with liquidity?
No issues with liquidity. It's in a separate account, okay, which we like there, so we hold all the securities. So very liquid portfolio.
Okay. At one point in time, I thought being in that, those asset classes actually benefited on, yeah, like inadvertently
during
when the market
during
the short terms would
do. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like we didn't intend to take a bet on duration, but
yeah,
having a very low duration portfolio helped us quite a bit.
Right.
The last, kind of
position and down,
yeah,
market.
So pre 2022, it was a big headwind because the opportunity cost was high. Cash rates were essentially zero.
Exactly.
And then when the huge bump during 2022, et cetera, then all of a sudden, it was a great place to be. And so since then, it hasn't been a headwind. If you just park cash and essentially get a guaranteed 4 to 5% mm-hmm. when you need to make 6.5%, that's a pretty good starting point.
Right. Very good. And if you were to consider looking at the alternatives for what you're saying, the securities lending or credit line from the city, will we lose that value that could be generated during this time? Would it just be like stagnant if the money were to move, or was it just a portion of it?
Yeah,
kind of curious.
Good topic. So securities lending, I've never seen it generate the amount of money that has been de minimis. And back in the day, you could take extra risks, but then you got penalized like in 2008.
Right.
When you were taking on more duration or lower quality credit. Since then, everybody moved to essentially cash rate, so the 3A7 type vehicle. And so from that perspective, you're just making the same as you're making in your cash account, plus or minus.
Nothing. Leo, is there any counterparty risk in doing that in the security lending side?
There is.
There is,
right? Some, but usually banks will hold.
They're not worth it.
Will cover those if there is any, and that's why you have, 102 usually for domestic, 105 as a percentage of the collateral that gets put up by the borrower. So from that perspective, that rarely happens. The big risk is the investment risk, and that's the one that was. And that's when you went wrong in 2008. Let's just say you had auction rate securities and those froze. That was a big deal. Then you had no access unless you really made up the hole. You couldn't access what you thought were your liquid assets. And so I don't think securities lending will solve any of these issues. Accessing a line of credit from a third party usually comes at a cost. If the city provides one for free, that's worth the conversation. But from my experience in 20 plus years working with public pension funds, I learned to rely on what you can control, because sometimes things change out of what you can control. And so unless you got a strong guarantee, I would not just rely on that as my source, and I would prefer to have something that I have higher degree of control.
Yeah, just a quick point. I agree completely with Leon's point. Securities lending has really become de minimis at the end of the day. And the risk is, particularly if some of those securities are international, coincidentally, if they're hot and they're in demand, you don't always get them back when you need to, and there's penalties there. So that's the risk. But there, you know, with the city and other factors, there's other opportunities. Quick question on returns. How often does Makeda run expected rates of return over 3, 5, 10-year periods in terms of volatility and expected rates?
You mean future projections based upon capital market expectations for different asset classes? We can do it anytime. We have a portal that your staff as well can jump in and model those. That's pretty easy to do.
You get to update those.
We do that. We update the assumptions at least yearly. There's a lot of noise in the market twice a year. And so at a minimum, every 6 to 12 months, we do it and we discuss the impact of changes in interest rates, valuation, et cetera, on different asset classes.
Okay, good to know.
To answer one of the earlier questions on the drawdown in 22, we were in a drawdown mode from kind of early 22 to March of 23. We drew it down to about 12 months remaining, started at 18 months. Some of that was money coming back from the private side that went back into the safe reserve. But that's just kind of checking reports. That's the level we drew it down to.
So checking my math, what is that, about $40 million, $50 million?
Probably more. That's going to be more.
It was from the target, $55 million. We may have started a little bit above target there. But it was what we did in that case. It was a combination of when proceeds came back, we rebalanced a little bit into equity markets. And then when proceeds came back, we split them, talking to the board between $40 million came back, $20 million going to state reserves, $20 million going into equities.
So this chart on the screen, so for as of August, this is as of June, but what's interesting is that the fund value is about the same as when we started working with you in spring of 18. So for that, we went through a lot. The market in general went up, but we've been cash flow negative. But the good news is that, you know, that amount, that deficit has been coming down from 10 million a month to about 6 million. So that's good news. You saw something similar. Again, this is 74% in daily or liquid. I just looked at the numbers a little while ago, and it was about 46% in 2018. And the red one, which is 19, was also about 47% or so. So it was about an even split back then. So today, certainly a lot greater liquidity in your portfolio. And that provides more options. So here's the manager's scorecard. And this changed over time. Brian alluded to Boston Partners and how it changed. It would have been no and red just a year or two ago. Their heavy focus on deep value, mostly European, Japanese holdings, have done very well of late. And so it went from being an underperformer to an overperformer, and we understood the role. And so we had several conversations with trustees at the time and with the staff and decided to keep it, and it has been the right call. I think a good way to think is 10 years is the minimum typically to look at, and you should expect there's going to be 3 and 5 year windows in that 10-year horizon when the strategy is not going to be in favor. So jumping into Walter Scott, you take a longer view. They've been doing this for decades. The last 5 years performance has turned weak, the last 2 years weakest. It's not the first time, but it is not ideal. But we understand what they're doing. We are actually conducting a full on-site later this month. So we'll spend the better part of half a day, maybe a full day, looking at everything. I don't know what will come out of it, but I don't think we'll be surprised. I think they're what they're doing. They're not buying into the higher price. Both here are more momentum-oriented. They're also not looking into cyclical. They're a bit further in the middle. Hasn't been the place to be as of now. They're not making any significant changes. You can say we, you know, continue to work. We'll do even deeper dives in what we own and what we could be owning to understand what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. So we report back to Ryan. I think that is in about 2 weeks. Manulife shows now it's slightly behind, not meaningfully, but you know it's been holding since day one, since we came on board. At different times we debated. I know it's been discussed as a potential search for replacement at some point in time, but so far it's with us. We'll continue to discuss that. So that's something potentially for action for 26. Eastern Shore, as Ryan mentioned, is gone. And the last one is Global Alpha, which, according to when you measure it, you know, they had period of strength and period of weakness. The last couple of years have been tough. I think that's probably the tougher of those. It deals with small cap, which has been some headwinds, and deals with errors on the portfolio manager in terms of some of the holdings. So, stock picking hasn't been great. And lastly, as a result of that, they, you know, we had a meeting recently where, you know, about to issue a report we'll share with Ryan and your staff once we have it, maybe within a week. But, you know, they mentioned some adjustments. But those adjustments are qualitative in nature, and so not very specific, not very strict. And so a lot of discussions among themselves, which it's a bit uncertain as to what, if anything, will turn into. So,
Leo, a question.
Yeah.
When does changes become a style drift?
Yeah. For that one, you use
especially if you're saying that there have not been good stock picks.
During recent times, I think if you look at the, you know, history since inception, they have shown to add value. The recent two-year period hasn't been particularly strong for them. So to figure that out, you look at a combination of qualitative and quantitative analysis. The quantitative, it's hard data, et cetera. You can map over time and see if there's any trends that are away from what your understanding and their communication of what they were going to do. And then the qualitative aspect of it, so investing in the mix of an art and a science. And so that's the part that comes with experience and a degree of, you know, a feel for what's right. So we compare that again with what others are doing that are in the same space, and ultimately we come up with a view, and it's always going to be a combination of, you know, quantitative output plus qualitative opinion or analysis. So there's no rule, unfortunately, to figure that out.
As you think about the dimension of time, though, like how much time has to pass before then you make, you know, a qualitative assessment of changing, you know, management?
No, that we make it anytime at all times, but there's a lot of noise in the short term. So once you see that play out over longer horizons, it's a lot easier to form a picture. So,
and how you define that longer term horizon?
Yeah, usually it's a full cycle, but cycles change. So sometimes, you know, if you think about equities, you're talking at least 3 to 5 years at the bare minimum, preferably longer. So in your case, we would look at, you know, your history since you hired them, but this manager has a prior history that goes back to, I think, 2009. So from that perspective, it's, you know, about 15 years of data that now we have. So yeah, you wouldn't be just looking at your performance. That's what you see here. There's a lot of history prior.
Well, shouldn't, when you look at a particular manager, shouldn't it be the full cycle in which they invest in?
Yeah, but that,
so you're saying that some of these, so basically when you were talking about, like, I think it was Walter Scott, I'm not sure if it was Manu or Walter Scott, you were saying, like, they're longer. So if you look at them at a 10-year, how many cycles was that in their, of their discipline occurred in that 10-year? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and they change over time. So I think since you go, so I think the last change was in 2008, 2009, and then since then we had, you know, a pretty consistent period when, you know, we're talking global investing. So you're talking about the U.S. outperforming by a wide margin, large cap outperforming by a wide margin, growth outperforming value by a wide margin. So with a few minor changes, it hasn't really changed. The last year, somewhat, so you see a reversal in currency, you see overseas small caps doing better than the large caps, value doing better than growth in some areas. It's just been the growthier names, the Mag 7, that have been doing very well in the U.S., and because the U.S. has grown from a third to two-thirds of the market over the several decades now, it dominates. And so that piece offsets many of the other trends.
On multi-strat, I would say, like, if we see the Mag 7 struggle and they're not outperforming, or there's a down market and they're not protecting the downside, that's where I would get much more concerned than I am now. And then to Tony's question, I think if we're hiring active managers to go into the portfolio, unless something changes with personnel, organization, style, like, if we can't give them 3 years, like, that's the minimum time we should, you know, be willing to stick with the manager. You know, and Leo says, like, you know, more longer term, but like when we talk about it internally, it's like until they get to 3 years, you know, there's not, we can look at what they're doing and make sure the styles have changed, but we need to accept that going active is going to have periods of underperformance and periods of outperformance. And when we put all these managers together, we should have a portfolio that outperforms the benchmark, which, you know, depending on the endpoint, but for most time periods, we've outperformed in the equity portfolio.
That's what I was looking for. There's a very real opportunity cost. So as you say, generally 3 years, that's helpful.
Yeah.
But I appreciate that you don't want to get schizophrenic and start changing managers.
It's going to come back to bite you. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's got to be some problems.
Yeah.
There's some.
No, and like Leo said, on Global Alpha, we've been with them 3 years now, and we're looking hard at that one. You know, they'll come back with their findings, and when we get concerned about a manager or they're underperforming, we'll connect with Leo's team on the research side and compare notes and see what they think and come back to you guys with a recommendation.
Well, there's a subtext of what Tina was saying, which I think we want to make sure we don't lose, which is looking at this is just against the benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't explain why you're not hitting the benchmark, you better have a darn good reason, which is we like Apple. We think Apple's going to do the following thing. Talking to management, we think that's going to pan out. And we're sticking with that. Well, we're sticking with that underwriting evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And this is a wonderful segue to what I am going to bring up to the late and great Shadrow. So he was a big proponent of why buy the manager when you can buy the bogey, okay? And so why aren't we having a more a discussion with it?
Again, what was he an advocate of? I just couldn't hear you.
Chad Rowe used to talk about, like, why buy the manager when you can buy the bogey that they're trying to beat.
Unless there's an alpha, right?
Right, exactly. If there's an alpha, a proven alpha. But that's very difficult, and it's been proven to be very difficult. And I really want to reintroduce this idea of actually having some sort of thought process about buying the bogey instead of the manager for some point of allocation in any asset allocation. Because, I mean, if we're looking at these guys, I mean, if we're buying that index, if we're buying that bogey, and it's cheaper, we're paying for bad performance.
Okay.
Even if we're not paying, because there is a poor performance generated, and so therefore they don't get the performance, they don't do well. But like, I just want to just reintroduce this. Maybe this is a discussion for the investment advisory committee.
Yeah, so it's totally hear you. It's one of the topics that we have. We're looking at active passive, kind of global positioning, small cap. To go back to the IAC, I would say we bought both because we have 40%, you know, in. Of the equity portfolio in an index fund, actually more now with Eastern Shore. And even though we have some red on this page, collectively, we are beating the bogey. So even though a few managers are not, I think we need to look at the combination of all of these and understand if there's manager-specific issues, concerns,
but
changes needed.
How much we're paying for it versus for the cheapness of it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's other things in, you know, how much are we beating? On a collective way, how much effort is that, and how much are we paying for that? So I think those are other factors to consider when buying, that, like I said, the bogey versus manager.
So you're comfortable.
Without prejudging, I really second Tina's recommendation that we do an assessment on that issue.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm actually pile on. I actually think you've got a great investment team.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than chasing these guys around to figure out if they have style drift and figure out whether or not we should be active or passive, if you fired them all, put all of those publics in an index and took that time and focused on private credit, focused on venture, focus on other alternatives, would you generate a better return and beat the benchmark because you're going to the places where you've got a better chance of beating the benchmark? And I can't answer that, Ryan, but I do know you have a small team. And so if you have a SEAL team or a Delta Force team, you don't use them to fight conventional battles. You use them to do something unconventional.
Let me provide some reflections to all of these topics and themes. First, when you look at a scorecard like this, you need to understand that it's a snapshot in time, number one. Number two, the decision on the benchmark is arbitrary. There's multiple benchmarks that could be chosen. Sometimes these benchmarks that we chose for managers here may not match the preferred benchmark from the manager because we made our own decision collectively. Number two, it doesn't account for the risk taking. And so a manager may be lagging, but maybe they took a lot less risk, and that is okay. Maybe in a risk-adjusted basis, they are ahead. So these will not tell you that. Fourth, you may have a no because you're behind. You may just be behind 10 basis points or 300, and this doesn't tell you that magnitude of underperformance.
Then you should have given us the information.
We have. So, I mean, at the end of the day, and you understand you're relatively new, but we used to bring very long books and said, no, make it shorter and make it. So we've been changing that several times. So we can bring you more, and then at some point in time, there may be a new trustee that says, we need less. This is too much. So we will adjust to whatever the board wants. And so we try to be efficient in what we bring to you. But, yeah, that information.
That's a good point. You say that when you have a manager that you don't have a perfect benchmark, do you ever use a combination, like a ratio of a benchmark? That would be useful.
We could. And so, for example, the issue is here we may use an equi, but maybe it's very growth or very value. And so we sometimes have both. And so sometimes we include or exclude emerging markets into it, depending on what the historical use has been. So all I'm saying is it's good to follow these, and I think the main use is to understand which should be focused managers to spend more time than the rest, and not just to make decisions as a result of these. Right. I would not recommend making a decision. You have to fire somebody because they have three reds in a row.
Sure. One other thing, too, this is something for the IOC to work on. There's a process to go through to determine what's the best benchmark as far as Samurai. And this is something that we'll bring up at the IOC meeting going forward. Evaluate our benchmark.
Steel teams and Samurai.
Yeah.
With carbon.
My last comment is on active versus passive. It's a great topic. We've been discussing, as Ryan mentioned, we'll be discussing again at the next investment committee meeting. It had been zero at some point in that.
We
went from zero to over 40. So don't lose track of that. It used to be 100% actively managed. And so I think, you know, somewhere near that 50th percent is pretty reasonable. I think there is phase for active management to execute. I think, yes, you know, perhaps focusing on areas where there's the greatest dispersion of returns is most important. As an example, in liquid alternative areas, it's a huge dispersion, so if you pick the better managers, you'll do well, but you're not guaranteed that you're going to get those. And so for now, this is what we have most of our assets, so we're trying to find the best mix. And by and large, I would say the public markets have delivered excess returns, both in absolute versus benchmarks and on a risk-adjusted basis. So I think over the last 3 to 5 years, this has been the case, and that went from being, you know, 30-40% of the fund to now being 80%. So it has been in the past.
Yeah, I'm appreciative of this discussion. I mean, very appreciative of what Ryan has done. Like, think about IL-9 that's been happening for the last 5 years, right? But this is the type of strategic stuff that we should be talking about and focusing on. This is what's going to drive, you know, the value creation in the plan for participants and beneficiaries, right? Like, this is where a lot of the focus going forward should be. So I'm appreciative of having this discussion. This is a good discussion for this board to be having, you know, about how do we create value, maximize value. So, thank you.
I'll try to get the page.
Sorry. Just on this page, I don't like it, but it's a good scorecard. So what I would do if I was a trustee, if I saw, you know, global alpha with a bunch of reds, I would, if you could go ahead to 17 of your report, Leo, and just kind of, or just call me and we can talk through it, but like, it's hard to see, but global alpha, this will show their actual performance versus benchmark, as in where they rank in their peer group. So like on the 1 year, they're underperforming by a significant margin, but the entire peer group hasn't kept up with that benchmark, so they're still not great, but in the top half of that benchmark at 42 percentile. You kind of see the same thing on the year-to-date. And this is just an example, not to defend Global Alpha, but the more meaningful information is on these pages back here.
All right, let me look at a couple more pages, and if you have questions, ask me along the way. But this is one that, you know, maybe about 4 or 5 years ago we began to include on a quarterly basis. There were lots of questions at the time about how much in the U.S. do we have versus peers versus the passive benchmark. The reality is that at every single measurement point, your actively managed strategies have had underweights to the U.S. And for most of the time, it hasn't worked. But the last year or so is being a great value driver. And so with the dollar depreciating roughly 10%, groups like Boston Partners participated the most. They own 66% outside of the U.S. In developed markets and very little in EM. So overall, you have about a 10-point underweight to the U.S. That has moved into non-U.S., and that has been very value additive. So with a 10% net spread this year, that 10%, yeah, that's about 1% in returns. Here's your performance. If you look, for example, at the 3 years, that's very strong at 12%, about double your actuarial assumed rate of return. It's on par with the policy and well ahead of your peers. So overall, in 2018-17, you would look at this same picture and it would be about flat. And you'll see peers with 5 to 10%. So there would be a huge delta between your performance and peers and far behind your assumed rate of return. So as you had more liquid assets and especially equities, and equities have done particularly well, you have risen to the top. And so when you look at 3 years, you know, this fund has been a top decile performing against funds that are $1 billion or above. So what hasn't worked recently? It's a continuation of what we've been discussing now for a number of years. So mostly your illiquid assets have been pretty flat. Sometimes they don't get marked, sometimes they get markdowns, whereas the rest of the book is moving up. And so that's your green on the left, private equity, real estate, natural resources. And this is over 3 months. The rest has been anywhere from neutral to good. When you look at 1 year, it's more or less the same. And it has been consistent now for a while. Looking at relative versus peers, so each dot represents, you know, public pension funds between $1 and $5 billion in assets. You look at your green square, that's your actual fund. So you want to be top left, you want to be Seattle, not Miami, and that means you get a high return with a relatively low variability of those returns. Yes, Tina?
No, no.
Oh, I thought you had a question. So if you backtrack 7 years ago, it would have been on the bottom right. That's where we were.
We want to stay there.
Ideally, yeah.
No pressure.
I think I will skip all of this. You've seen the same charts as of August. It's more recent performance. There's nothing different when you stop the clock in June and August. The only difference is we used to have your Eastern Shore. Other than that, it's the same portfolio.
I think we probably need to move on. But the last thing I would say, unless you have any closing remarks on performance on that 10-year number, we kind of knew this was going to happen based on some work we did, but there's a lot of publicity around the 2% return on the 10-year that's jumped up to 3.9, and a lot of that is those write-offs from 15 rolling out of that 10-year window. So we expect that 10-year number to continue to climb as more of those write-offs drop out of that window and our public portfolio is performing well.
Okay.
I won't take from that.
No, go ahead.
So I on this chart, which is
what page?
I think it's page 6. 72.
Okay.
what if you just thought? I mean, was Huff segregated from our private?
It was split up from private equity. It's not segregated from the private.
So it's split up.
Yeah, so we have a separate line item for Huff, but when we add up 19% in private markets, it's still very much a private market asset included in that 19%.
Okay. That's a zero target.
It's its own asset class.
It has a zero target.
Yeah.
Because I did notice that on that next, the one we were just on. But it has zero target, but it does, is that number.
Yeah.
It, how much of that, what is the percentage of that 19? Is that?
6.7.
So that's what you see on this page, page 86. So the half energy was segregated. It represents blended 6%. It's been at that level for quite some time. The dollar value hasn't really changed. And again, Tina, the reason for doing that was to have a better view as to, okay, what can we do in the rest and what we wait for some resolution with this holding.
Right. So it wouldn't deter us from like what we're trying to do in the private.
Correct. If you're good at that, then you'll be, oh, when I'm overweight, I wouldn't be making. But this is not going to be generating. This is going to be appreciating. It's not going to be throwing much cash flow. It's kind of dormant in there until there is some exit at some value at the time.
Okay. And so the point I was trying to make is that even though it shows this moment in time, the targets are less than that. And so do you see what I'm saying? It's like if you take that 6% out, then we're underweighted.
Big time. Yeah, you got 1.5 versus.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. So.
Yeah, and that was the framework to ultimately get comfort and begin to make investments in the liquids, and that's why you conducted a search, hire an advisor, and you're beginning to do that. Okay, I think we're pretty much done. Let me see. Again, this is the same allocation versus target with half segregated, and then I'll just end at this page. So we've been going through a gradual transition, reducing illiquid assets. So real assets was a huge component. It's now more manageable. Private equity was larger. Credit infrastructure, those have been smaller. They remain in the books. But what's interesting is that equity went from less than 30% 5 years ago, now close to 60. And then fixed income, I know it's been discussed for potential reduction, at least some mentioned, well, maybe we'll reinvest this in a place that generates more money. But if you really look at everything, that 13% you have in fixed income and cash is all you spend. It's all that you have to rely upon to meet benefit payments, to rebalance into a period of weakness, because your liquid assets are not going to be throwing off cash then, your equity is going to be down, and so if you want to be able to redeploy at lower valuations, you need to have something that maintained value or went up in value. That's going to be your cash and high-quality bonds. And so we can debate if you don't like cash and you move it into more duration, but I think getting lower than 10% into assets like these, you know, would be a long and hard conversation to be had. You could potentially try to find other assets that would be offsetting, from gold to other, you know, high quality currencies or hedge funds or some strategies that would have negative correlation to drawdowns in equity. Those would be good discussions to have now that we have more options to take. So with that, I think I'll close my prepared remarks and thank you for your time and questions.
Thanks, Leo.
Very good.
Good questions from everyone and a lot of stuff to look at in the equity portfolio. I'll quickly go through the private markets report. This is an Allborn produced report. Just a few pages to highlight here. I'm on 102. So this report includes all of our historical investments in private markets. So you can see there's, I think, 88 total investments included in this report. It has returns on the entire portfolio. Some of these investments date back to 1992, so a full history of all the private markets included here. As we add new private markets to the portfolio, we're going to break those into sub-composites, so it's very clear, a new portfolio performance versus legacy. We're not to that point yet because we don't have money in the ground, but that's what we plan to do with this report. I'm going to flip ahead a few slides here to... Ooh. 107, and this is just looking at the bottom chart, the J curve of you can see the amount of capital here that went into the ground in that 05 to 09 time period. And then kind of starting with the secondary sale in 16 when money started coming back to us. So it'll look a little bit like this going forward with a much shallower J curve as we add new investments to the portfolio. And then if you want to see performance on the current investments in the portfolio, so they're here on 112, just on the color coding that Auburn uses, orange would be fourth quartile, yellow third quartile, light green second quartile performance, and dark green first quartile. Like I said, this report will become much more useful as we start adding investments into the private markets portfolio. In the back, you can see kind of line item by line item performance on each of the investments that have been closed out. So any questions on this report? Okay, we're going to bring AEW in now.
Oh, sorry, Brian, we're going to change the order to keep things interesting.
Okay.
So what we'd like to do is skip the AEW review for now, take the other items that will be done in open session first, then we'll go, which will be items 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, and those should all go fairly quickly. And then we'll go back to AEW. There'll be three-ish slides in open session. Then when we go into closed session, we can do AEW, legal, and the medical item all at once instead of going in and out. So that's the plan. Does that work?
Perfect.
That leaves Brenda up next.
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to discuss the financial audit status. At this point, most of the audit work has been completed. Depending on when we receive the completed actuary report, we will present the audited financial statements and the ACFR to the board in either October or November. Staff is busy working on all the portions of the financial statements and the ACFR that we can now as we wait for the last piece of the actuary report, and we'll be excited to bring that to you in the near future. Are there any questions?
How much of a delay will Huff create?
Huff, both Huff and Lone Star, those valuations have been presented to BDO. They have reviewed them. They've sent back questions. We've answered those questions. So it would only be if there's like a second round of questions on those.
So we didn't get Huff reporting. We had alternate procedures.
Yes, that's right. That's right. We would do that. Yeah. Forgot about that.
Any other questions?
Okay. Board members, the next three items are standing items that we have on all the agendas, and I usually cover them in about a minute and a half. But slow me down if you have any questions. So the first item, I don't know who has the clicker, but is the ministerial actions on page 131. Thank you. And what, as the executive director, I approve a variety of benefits transactions every month, and then I just bring information to the board and let you know kind of what went on during the month as far as our members are concerned with benefits we've set up or refunds, those types of things. And I will always bring it to your attention if there's something unusual here. This month in September, you can see retirements are down, but retirements are typically down in September if you look at the 2 years that are previous there. I can tell you we received a lot of phone calls from police department employees looking to retire a lot more than normal. And what is unusual this time is a lot of them are in their 40s, like early 40s. So what happens is they call up and they'll say, I need to leave now. We will come talk to us. And usually what happens is when we explain to them what their pension will be if they leave now versus if they stay till they're 50 or later, they calm down, go back, and, you know, continue their career.
So what's the now? What's the urgency?
I don't know. It's not unusual when there's a new police chief, when changes happen, that we get, you know, call. So I don't know if it's that or I don't know what's going on. But we get these surges every once in a while. This one is just, we don't normally get, a lot of them are between the ages of 40 and 45, which is the unusual part. So just something's going on over there. I'm not sure what it is, but we'll, you know, we're talking them off the ledge.
From what I've been told, everybody's
we're not going to have 30-year officers anymore. Everybody's hitting 20 and leaving. So they're going to be 45 years old. They're going to go do something else. Sometimes they're going to go try to find a another career with a different department that has a COLA. It's really that simple. That's what I'm hearing from everybody. And so it's going to be harder and harder with Gen Z, who likes to job hop anyways. But when you have departments that are already offering better pay, and you have, you know, and the economy is still fairly good in other areas, and you can go do something else or do something very similar for more pay or better, more concrete retirement, they're just gone. They say, I got 20 years, I don't have to take it till I'm 50, and I'm good. And I'm hearing that from everybody. I'm hearing that from, there's chief that makes comments about it. So that's just the reality. That's the reality of where we're at as because of the questions about the pension and how it's funded and the COLA.
So one of the things, I was at a pension funding forum conference a month or so ago, and there was an interesting bar chart that I gave to our counselors, and it shows, and actually Chiron did the presentation, it was interesting. It shows if you go someplace and you have a defined benefit plan and you work your whole career, your benefit will be, you know, this big. If you go someplace, you work the same number of years, but you do that and you have a defined benefit plan in both, but it's at two different organizations, the two parts do not equal the whole. And that's a tool that I think we could explain to people. You might go and replace that, but you're losing ground just because of the way a defined benefit plan works. So, you know, we're trying to help them understand the math. Yeah, that's one of the things we're doing. So then the next standing item is this, it's a little hard to read here, is a contribution report. This used to be more meaningful report before this year when we actually were paid based on 34.5%. But now what this chart does, and this was a request from the board, we're comparing what the city's paying based on their plan versus what we believe to be the law, which is the plan that the board adopted, and the difference. So for this fiscal year, we're $11.6 million under what we believe the contribution should be. There was a shortage in 2024 of about $3 million, so in total it's $14 million. So I'll update this every month and then just let you know where we are. It's just informational.
It's not what we believe, it's what the plan,
correct.
The law. So they're $14 million short of what the law requires them to.
Right, and
very clear
that the court has affirmed. Right.
And no assumptions.
And roughly $60 million. So there was a comment before that the city needs to know what we need. The plan currently, what they're paying at is $60 million for the AEC for this year. So that's what we need, is to have a full AEC paid out every year. So with the step up, the 3-year step up, we're $12 million short right now. That's what the step up. What we need is a full AEC now so we can solve this problem, so we can stop having police and fire going to other organizations after we spend $275,000 per person to train them. That's what's needed.
But to be clear, to be fair about this, it begs the question about what the law requires. That's the issue that we are currently litigating. And so that's just the respective positions of the pension system and the city.
Right, and I think that's probably as far as we can go related to the legal part in the open session. So there's the next item. This is also a standing item. So for the new trustees, you are required, as all trustees of pension plans in Texas, to do continuing education. The first amount of education you need to do is a little bit strange, I guess, in the segments. It's not something you think, hey, well, I already do this education, I will probably qualify. It probably won't for your first round of training. The pension review board does have online classes that are free, but in addition to that, we have a budget money that's set aside if you want to do training. The way we do that is every month you'll see a list of typically NCFERS and TexFERS training classes. If you're interested in going to any of those, you just bring it up at this meeting. The board will vote on that. We'll record the fact that you've asked, and as you can see here, next page. In June, Michael Tagliante and Matt asked to go to the NCPRS training. The board approved it June 12th, so they'll go in October. After they go to the training, they'll come back and report out whether they thought it was useful or not. So any of these trainings, you're welcome to go to. We'll help you with the scheduling. If there's other things you want to go to, that's also okay. Just let us know. We'll put it on here for approval.
Are there any that are strategic to have us be at, you know, coverage-wise?
I don't think strategic. I think some are better than others, which is one of the reasons that we report out. I think the NCPRS, my favorite NCPRS is a funding forum that I just went to because I like the actuarial stuff, but their annual conference is good, which is this fall conference. Is it the fall conference? It's the eighth conference.
Oh, the financial actuarial.
But yeah, they're all, most of them are pretty good. That's why we kind of report out so people can say it's worth our time or it wasn't worth it.
Well, if there's anything that would be considered strategic for the benefit,
okay,
you know, for us to go to.
Okay, we'll let you know. Thank you. All right, thank you. That I'll turn it back to Brenda.
Thank you. Today I'll be discussing two possible budget amendments. The first one is an amendment to our capital budget. As many of you may have experienced, the audio quality of our board meetings can be inconsistent and often has poor quality. And also the boardroom does not have video capability. The staff is recommending a capital budget amendment to enhance the quality and accessibility of the meetings for trustees, IAC members, presenters, members, or the general public. The boardroom will become a high-functioning video conferencing space with integrated voice-activated camera switching, multi-microphone array coverage, and ceiling speaker audio playback. And cameras will be mounted around the room. If approved, the project is expected to be completed by year-end. The system and installation will cost just under $110,000. It will be a capital expense, and it would be depreciated over a five-year period. Are there any questions about the audio-video improvements?
I'd like to comment. If any of you board members have ever experienced not being here and dialing in, you would realize the dire need for that expenditure because it becomes extraordinarily difficult to hear what other people are saying, to actually respond, and in some instances, if you want to see people's votes, the video would be very useful, and if that's at all value-added to you, because it's not good now.
I completely agree.
Yeah, for the second time this morning, I want to second Tina's recommendation. We have a dysfunctional accessible system. We just can't operate at long distance without a change.
When you presented the budget for the 6 months, how much under budget will be in a year?
For the capital expenditure for the AV, we had not budgeted that item. We are about $500,000 under on professional and admin, more than that on the investment side because of management fees. Okay.
We could do a motion now, or we can wait until after we have the closed session items because it has to do with legal. Do you want to talk about the legal?
Sure.
Items?
So the second possible budget amendment. Let's see, I'm going to try and get this going back the right way. There we are. Is for legal expenses. Last month when I was doing the 6 month budget review, a question was asked about a possible budget amendment for legal expenses as we had exceeded the 6 month legal budget. So during the past month, the staff has reviewed legal expenses related to current litigation and determined that the expenses will exceed the annual amounts that were originally budgeted. And just for some background about our budgeting methodology, during the 2020 budget process, the board at that time directed staff to budget only for base litigation costs and not to budget for possible legal contingencies. And so we have followed that board direction in all of the ensuing budgets. So following that direction and based on recent history, our 2025 operating legal budget was $330,000, and the investment legal budget was $200,000. And after our review, the staff would like to propose an increase to the 2025 operating budget for legal expenses of $730,000 and $600,000 for the 2025 investment legal budget. Are there any questions?
Operating budget is what's the period?
The operating budget increase is $730,000.
No, I mean when does the calendar, when does that start? Is that a calendar or is that?
It's calendar.
Calendar, okay. And does that include all the costs of the appellate activity currently underway?
That includes, so the operating budget covers essentially, it's a lot of small legal, but the big drivers are the two cases with the city and the case with the retirees on the COLA. And so that includes, that captures everything we've spent to date as well as what's projected to go through the end through December 31st.
That's helpful. Thank you.
So if you don't need more detail on the legal to be discussed in closed session, then we could go ahead and do a motion now, or we can wait and do a motion after if you do have more questions.
I would say I don't think we need, I mean, order of magnitude, given what we're involved in, is eminently reasonable, in my judgment.
So, can we get a motion to increase this 2025 operating budget by $1,330,000 and the 2025 capital budget by $110,000?
I'll move.
Can we take those in two separate moves?
Okay, so can I get a motion to increase the 2025 operating budget by $1,330,000.
So moved.
Okay, a second?
I'll second.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Nay.
Guys have it.
Can I get
a motion to increase the 2025 capital budget by $110,000?
So moved.
Okay, a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you. We're going to go back to items now.
Okay. So, get the Ada before we go to the real estate.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Brenda. Right there. All right, I want to welcome Mark Morrison here at Cassidy from AEW. And as most of you guys know, AEW took over a real estate portfolio from DPFP in 2015. A lot of those investments dated back to the early 2000s. When they came in, it was a very complicated, highly levered, risky portfolio. They've, you know, I'll let Mark get into the numbers, but they've worked it down to a level that's brought a lot of cash back to the plan, and there's a few key assets remaining and light at the end of the tunnel and on an ultimate exit. So we're pleased with the job they've done on the portfolio. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mark to provide a high-level overview, and then we'll move over into closed session.
Thank you, Ryan. President and Commissioners, thank you for your time today. As Ryan mentioned, my name is Mark Morrison. I'm Portfolio Management. Portfolio manager for the separate account. With me is Eric Cassidy, who's head of portfolio manager and a managing director. As Ryan mentioned, we were hired in 2015 to oversee three investments on behalf of the pension, Bright Consolidated Holdings, Camel Square, and Creative Tractions. Our original goal was to really go down and work through and put together a strategic plan to ultimately decrease the pension's exposure to these investments while also providing transparency into these complicated investments. Proud to say that we've been pretty successful over the last 10 years doing that on your behalf. Decreasing your exposure at the maximum, the NAV we oversaw was approximately $330 million versus the $124 million today. And importantly, a lot of that NAV came through the distributions that we've generated through the sale of non-strategic assets. Our dreams will be generating some attractive investments, though, again, just a little bit. You know, over the last 5 years, generated almost $200 million of proceeds back to the pension. Looking at the three investments, I don't want to get into too much detail here, but kind of want to highlight. Creative Attractions was a experiential restaurant operating development company. It was non-profitable and required significant cash contributions from the pension to keep that afloat. We made the decision that it wasn't a strategic asset, and we got out of that asset in 2017, therefore decreasing the pension's risk of future cash requirements without generating attractive risk-adjusted returns. That was a big win at that time. Camel Square was a asset plot of land that was located in Phoenix, Arizona, that under our stewardship was rezoned into a mixed use that included hotel, office, self-storage, apartments, and medical office. We made the decision based upon our review that it was strategic to sell the almost all of the assets to individual developers at what were some of the highest per square foot land prices in Phoenix. Based on speaking with staff and ultimately getting the board approval, we did decide to move forward with a development of a medical office building that was extremely successful. It almost generated a 1.8x equity invested within that asset. Overall, we sold the Camel Square for approximately $70 million of distributions back to the pension fund, which is included within that $200 million I've mentioned. And then the last that leaves Reg Consolidated Holdings, which is the last asset that we currently own. It's a 50-50 joint venture within an operating and development mixed-use company with located in Phoenix that has assets throughout Phoenix and the Midwest. As Ryan said, when we took it on board, it was very complicated. They had significant liabilities due to the advisement of the previous manager and general manager of the pension. We put out a strategic plan on how we were going to unwind that ultimately. We've been working through that the last 10 years. And as Ryan said, we're in a position where we think over the next couple of years we'll be able to get DPF out of that investment. And that's all I have for open session.
Okay. With that, we'll